by the Tunisian people. In other words, it's a unilaterally written constitution in accordance with the desires of Qais Saied, and therefore this is an imposition of a constitution as opposed to a democratic constitution, and therefore it's very unlikely that it's going to lead to this political stability that Qais Saied promises, especially given that even the trade unions who support the coup have announced that they are not going to support his constitution or support his roadmap.
The first article of Tunisia's 2014 constitution and its 1959 predecessor defined the country as a free, independent, and sovereign state. Islam is its religion and Arabic is its language. However, Tunisian President Kais Saied now says that the draft constitution to be put to a referendum on July 25 will not enshrine Islam as the religion of the state. What led to this decision and what is the significance of this announcement, especially considering that Ennahda, an Islamic party, is one of the most popular parties in the country?
I think it's important to remember one thing. The first is that Tunisia has often wrestled with the Islamic identity and has often wrestled with the Islamic identity in a bid to try to win international support. Kais Saied is removing Islam from the constitution in contradiction to what he said in 2014 when he said that this is a clause that should be supported. Kais Saied has removed this clause in the constitution in a bid to present his own coup as progressive to an international community that is not comfortable with his coup.
President Saied also dismissed 57 judges on June 1st, accusing them of corruption and protecting terrorists. The Tunisian Judges Association has rejected the charges, saying they are mostly politically motivated. Analysts believe the judges have been removed for failing to toe the president's line.
I think it's important to remember that since Kais Saied seized power for himself on the 25th of July 2021, almost a year ago, he's been dragging his political opponents before the courts and before military courts in a bid to try to convict them on charges of corruption. The idea here is that if Saied can convict his political opponents of corruption, then he can by extension convict the democratic process that he's overthrown of corruption. He can argue and say that I've overthrown a corrupt democratic process, and the proof is that these political opponents who have been elected are guilty of corruption.
Recently, Tunisia's main trade union confederation, UGTT, called up to 3 million public sector workers to strike, halting work at 159 state agencies and public companies to demand concessions on salaries and reforms. Now, UGTT chief Noureddin Tebboubi has also blamed the government for not including this powerful union in national dialogue. Now, what is the impact of the strike, and will the government respond positively to the workers' demands?
I think it's important to stress that the trade union strike against Kais Saied is not because of the conditions of the workers. It's not about workers' pay, even though that's what the trade unions claim it is about. Instead, it's about this power struggle that's unfolding between the trade unions and Kais Saied. The trade unions wholeheartedly backed Kais Saied's coup, but they believe that Kais Saied would be subservient to them, that they would be able to control Kais Saied, they would be able to influence Kais Saied, and they would be able to impose their own desire on the process of the coup in a manner similar to what they did with the National Dialogue in 2013, 2014. The problem, however, for the trade unions is that Kais Saied has monopolized power. He refuses to share power. He refuses to engage with the trade unions. The problem the trade unions have is that they don't want this coup to fall because they don't want the Islamists to come back to power. The leftist trade unions have a rabid hatred for the Islamists and are very frustrated that the Islamists keep winning in the democratic elections. So they want this coup to stay. The problem, however, is that Saied is not engaging them, and they are worried about going hard against Saied because they don't want this coup to topple.
The head UGTT trade union has rejected International Monetary Fund conditions for a new loan to bail out Tunisia's struggling economy and has questioned the government's authority to negotiate. President Saied has made concessions demanded by the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, cutting subsidies and wages.
An economist says if the government fails to convince the population, then it will not be able to implement economic reforms.
The negotiations with the IMF will take place amid an unprecedented economic crisis in Tunisia. Therefore, the authorities will make many sacrifices. The government needs to convince the population that the reforms are necessary. Otherwise, it will not be able to implement any change or reform.
Now, why is the president obeying these IMF conditions at the expense of the welfare of the people?
I think when it comes to the negotiations regarding the IMF, it's important to remember that Tunisia is in a very dire economic situation that is spiraling out of control and spiraling into ever-increasing crises and woes for the ordinary Tunisian. The reason that the Tunisians protested against the democratic transition or protested against parliament, the reason why many Tunisians are not interested in seeing parliament return, which is something that has helped Kais Saied, is because they believe that the parliament has not delivered on the aspirations of the Arab Spring, which were rooted in economic development. They wanted better jobs. They wanted they wanted the alleviation of poverty. They wanted equal opportunities. They wanted a better standard of living. None of that has been delivered. And Kais Saied is aware that as in 2016, 2017, Yusuf Shahid, the prime minister then, also had very high poll ratings when he first came to power and he was seen as combating corruption. But Yusuf Shahid's failure to tackle the economy meant that people very quickly turned against him.
Amid the political crisis in Tunisia, the government recently announced that it had launched an investigation of an attempt to assassinate President Kais Saied. Justice Minister Hasna Ben Saliman told a local radio that she approved the Court of Appeals prosecutor investigating the attempt, but gave no further details.
Now, our last question. Where is Tunisia heading in the next months and years amid the political turmoil and economic crisis?
I think the reality is that the international community appears to be approaching Kais Saied's coup as with the approach that is similar to that with which they approached the coup in Egypt when Sisi overthrew the democratically elected president. They are aware they are unable to get enough people to the streets to demand the return of parliament, and they've also changed tactic into recognizing the suspension of parliament but asking for an inclusive national dialogue, essentially offering a concession to recognize Saied's emergency measures in exchange for being included in the political process. And I think this is the tragedy of what is unfolding in Tunisia, in that at this moment in time, because of the dire economic situation, there's a lack of appreciation as to the importance of the democratic transition and more a focus on who can deal with the economic crisis, who can deal, whether it's democracy or dictatorship, just as long as they can deal with the economic crisis. And I think this apathy towards the democratic process is what benefits Kais Saied.
Well, there you have it. The dire economic situation in Tunisia has created apathy towards the democratic process in the country. We'd like to thank our guest Sami Hamdi for his incisive analysis, and we now take a short break before our next topic, which is on the continuing impact of the Ukraine conflict in Africa and how the Ukrainian president was recently snubbed by African leaders. Stay with us.
African leaders snub Ukrainian president.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
On the 20th of June, the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, addressed the African Union during a virtual meeting in which only four heads of state from the continent took part.
According to reports, all the heads of state of the continent were invited. But apart from the African Union chairman, President Macky Sall of Senegal, only three of them participated from their respective presidential offices: Alassane Ouattara of Ivory Coast, Mohamed El Menfi, president of the Libyan Council, and Denis Sassou Nguesso of Congo. In his belated address, the Ukrainian president tried to convince the few African leaders listening to him that the conflict in his country was a reason for the sharp increase in food prices.
This war may seem very distant to you and your countries, but catastrophically rising food prices have already brought it home to millions of African families.
Many in Africa hold the view that the conflict in Ukraine was imposed by Western powers. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa has openly blamed the US-led NATO military alliance for the war in Ukraine and said he will resist calls to condemn Russia.
For us, this is an important development. Whilst other people scream and shout, we want to focus on the outcome, the positive outcome of those negotiations and that mediation process. That is what is important.
For more on the conflict in Ukraine and its impact on Africa, we contacted Tshepo Magema, a former member of South African Parliament. Now, only four presidents were interested in holding a video conference with the Ukrainian president, while he had requested to address all African leaders after months of intense lobbying. Now, why did African leaders decide to snub Zelensky?
There is a general feeling both amongst the population of the African continent and the leadership that this is a war that should not have happened. It is a war that could have been prevented but for the hubris and arrogance of Western leaders, in particular the EU and the US. And so it led us and left us in this situation. And so there is that sense that, look, we don't want to be drawn into what is essentially a US slash EU slash NATO war, against Russia. And so there is that understanding that Russia had to act in one way or the other.
When the Ukrainian president was given a chance to address African Union leaders, he claimed that Africa is in reality a hostage of Russia's war. Let's listen in.
Africa is actually taken hostage, hostage of those who started the war against our state.
Remarks by the Ukrainian president have been termed by many as arrogant and typical of Europe's condescending attitudes towards Africa. Now, Mr. Magema, what's your take on these remarks by the Ukrainian president?
Look, generally as Africans, we take umbrage, at such arrogance for especially Westerners to want to tell us what our state is, what our conditions are. We are very clear, we are nobody's hostage. And indeed, the AU has taken such a position in general in terms of its attitude that we are nobody's hostage. We are indeed, there are some challenges that arise out of this thing, but we reject the notion, that we are hostage as if, as Africans, we do not have agency to act. And so it's actually, we see it as an affront to African agency to really, engage with the world and do business and pursue our own interests, as Africans. So, but then again, it is that kind of racist arrogance that we have, become accustomed to, and notwithstanding the fact that we've been rejecting it for all the centuries of colonialism since we got into contact with Western civilization. So in that sense, that statement means nothing to us. We don't see ourselves as hostages.
Well, the European Union has aggressively pursued sanctions and severing of economic ties in a bid to punish Russia for its military operations in Ukraine, a strategy that has attracted widespread criticism.
South Africa's president, Cyril Ramaphosa, has said that bystander countries were suffering due to sanctions against Russia.
Now, the sanctions that have been imposed on Russia are going to have and are having an overarching impact. Even those countries that are either bystanders or not part of the conflict are also going to suffer from the sanctions that have been imposed against Russia.
After imposing sanctions, Western countries are accusing Russia of being behind a worsening food shortage in Africa. Is it agreeable to claim that Russia is the main reason behind the so-called food crisis in Africa?
It seems to me that, a food crisis in Africa, put in those terms, is really being used as a, as a beating stick, a stick to beat Russia with, to say, but Russia, you are responsible for a food crisis in Africa, because Africa, of course, is one of those vulnerable parts of the world where we have famines and food crises breaking out every, now and then, every decade or two or so. And so in that sense, Africa, the crisis is not as deep, at least as some would suggest.
Since the beginning of the conflict between Ukraine and Russia, people in Africa condemn the double standards of treatment of African nationals. Many Africans were physically attacked by Ukrainian police and endured maltreatment from the country's authorities, including being left stranded and helpless in freezing temperatures. An African student speaks after escaping a harrowing experience in Ukraine.
I remember they punched a certain black guy, a policeman in Ukraine, punched a certain black guy for nothing. He was shocked for nothing. Yes, so like I said earlier on, they consider white people before considering black people.
Volodymyr Zelensky said in February that any African students who leave Ukraine will not be welcome there once the war is over. Africans will certainly never forget how they experienced racism while trying to escape the conflict in Ukraine.
Now, regardless of whether the conflict in Ukraine is the source of the food crisis in Africa or not, many agree that the continent needs to end dependence on food imports. The president of the Africa Development Bank, Akinwumi Adesina, says the bank is funding agricultural projects in the continent to end dependency on imports.
We have a $1.5 billion facility. It's not just the money. We have the systems in place across Africa. And that facility will allow African countries to produce 38 million metric tons of food. I told you we'll lose 30 million metric tons of food from Russia. So we produce 38 million metric tons of food. But that food will be broken down into what we're actually dealing with. There will be 11 million metric tons that will be wheat. There will be 18 million metric tons that will be maize. There will be 6 million metric tons that will be rice. 2.5 million metric tons that will be soybeans.
Now, what can African countries learn from the conflict in Ukraine, especially in terms of reviving agriculture and rebuilding regional sovereign grain reserves to avoid the current situation?
There's about 70% of the world's available arable land cannot ensure its food security. And so it's crucial that African leaders in earnest begin to work on practical projects, bankable projects that will ensure grain and wheat and fertilizer production on the continent. But that also, I must add, will require that we push the IMF and World Bank, who have, in fact, in many ways deindustrialized our agricultural sector and made it less profitable for African countries to grow their own food, vis-a-vis the importation of cheap products from abroad. And so that is the strategic task that face our continent and its leaders. And there needs to be really a lot of work. I mean, South Africa is doing well in that regard. It's a net exporter. That work must still continue and be expanded.
Well, indeed, Africa needs to ensure self-reliance in food security, and this requires dedicated leadership. We'd like to thank our guest, Isetho Magama, a former member of South African Parliament, for his insight today. And that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. Thanks a lot, and goodbye for now. We'll
This is Foresight. A program on how to worship Allah.
Allah, Allah, Allah.
Today's tip, why do we have a lack of attention and focus in our ubudiyah, our servitude, our worship, and our obedience to Allah?
Allah, 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 Allahu Rabbi.
So, dear listeners, we are humbly talking about why sometimes there is a lack of attention in our ubudiyah, in our servitude, our worship, and our obedience to Allah. Now, of course, I'm sure that some of us, if not many of us, has felt that sometimes in our formal and even informal forms of ubudiyah, we tend to have a lack of attention or lack of focus in what we're doing. Now, why do we have this lack of attention in our ubudiyah, our servitude, our worship, and our obedience to Allah? Yes, a lot of us suffer from this, but why do we suffer from this? Now, many times all we have to do is a little bit of reflection and we realize why is it that we have a lack of attention while we are conducting these different acts of worship and obedience to Allah. Of course, when it comes to formal ubudiyah, we have the five daily prayers or the recitation of the Quran or the recitation of various du'as and supplications and litanies and such. And we find that we don't give the due attention that we are supposed to. Well, one of the things that happens that causes us to have a lack of attention, of course, is having worries. And being busy in thinking about the different problems, trials, tribulations, calamities, difficulties that we face in our lives. Now, when our mind is busy with these worries and calculations and situations, then of course our heart is also busy in these kind of affairs, and likewise our soul will become busy in these worries and trying to figure out what we need to do. When in fact, we are standing in front of the Almighty Allah, we're going to take the Salah, the five daily prayers, as an example. When we are going to begin the Salah, the five daily prayers, right, this namaz, we should not be thinking about all these problems and these worries. Now, if we go a little bit deeper into this idea of why are we so worried, it kind of goes back to a lack of trust in the Almighty Allah. We worry about, for example, our livelihood. Well, if we try hard enough, will Allah not give us our livelihood? Or we worry about the future. If we try hard enough, will Allah not help us in our future? Or we're worried about an exam, or we are worried about our family life, or we are worried about the future of our children, or we are worried about this and that. Well, if we try hard enough, and I want to make sure that this is one of the things that is understood, that the first step, or at least one of the steps, is that we must try ourselves to fix our problems, and the rest we leave up to Allah. That what we weren't able to fulfill despite our efforts, Allah will fulfill and will help us to make up for those flaws and those errors. So if we remove these worries from our mind and our heart and our soul, we will be able to focus more and pay attention in our ubudiyah.
Ya Allah, Ya Allah, Ya Allah, Ya Allah,
Ya Manan, IRIB English Radio.
Our website is parstoday.com.
Ya Allah, Ya Rahman, haqqiq amanina, waffiqna fi kulli an fi ma sa'ina. Ya Allah, Ya Manan, haqqiq amanina.
أجب دعائي. رجائي بالرضا والخير أنير طريقي مع صديقي باحترام الغير.
And now we invite you to listen to Brother Nu'man Ali Khan.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu ka'u wasjudu wa'budu rabbakum wa'budu rabbakum wa'f'alu al-khayra la'allakum tuflihun.
Let me teach you what you will do to appreciate Allah. Here's how you appreciate Allah. Make ruku'ah, make sajda. What is both of these things referring to? Salat. You need to appreciate me. The first step in appreciating me will be salat. Where is your salat? How much we appreciate our salat is a good indication of how much we appreciate Allah. How active, how vigilant we are in getting up out of bed. How lazy we feel in making it to the masjid. How bored we are when the recitation is not entertaining enough. All of those are good indicators of where we stand before Allah Azza wa Jalla. You know, somebody who doesn't know about prayer, doesn't know about the Muslim prayer, a non-Muslim guy walks by and he sees people making salat. He's going to notice these people are standing with their head down. They're humble before somebody. Then they put their heads down like this halfway. Wow, they got even more humble. And when they got up, what happened next? Face on the ground, they got really humble. In other words, he's noticing that there's a progression in their humility to Allah, to whoever they're worshipping. They're getting even more and more and more subservient. There's seems like they're appreciating their master, they appreciated him more, and they appreciated him even more. The progression of salat itself teaches us that we're supposed to evolve, grow in our humility to Allah. So this idea that the more we serve, the more we're going to become humble. The extreme of humility, wasjudu. Then from there, because these two things still in the end, in essence, refer to salat. They refer to salat.
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is parstoday.com.
Welcome back to your listeners in continuation to what we were saying, which was, of course, trying to answer this question about why it is that we have a lack of attention in our servitude, in our obedience, in our worship, and in our ubudiyah to the Almighty Allah. Now, in the previous segment, of course, we talked about how one of the reasons why we have a lack of attention and a lack of focus in our ubudiyah is primarily because we are worried. We are worried about so many different things that we are just not able to pay attention and focus as we should in our ubudiyah. Now, we gave the example of the five daily prayers, the salah, the namaz, where when we stand up for prayers, it seems like we are thinking about everything in the world other than where our attention should be, which is the Almighty Allah. Now, another thing that we want to answer about why there's a lack of attention in our ubudiyah, of course, is because we are not consistent in our ubudiyah. And so when we are not consistent, when we are not regular in our servitude of Allah, at least when we are talking about the formal ubudiyah, which is the five daily prayers and the litanies and the supplications and such, when we are not consistent and regular in these prayers, then of course it becomes difficult to focus and pay attention. It's kind of like if you go to school for one day, and then for 1 week you don't go to school, and then after that week you go to school again for 1 day. That 1 day that you go to school to, it is very difficult to pay attention. Why? Because you're not used to it. You haven't become habituated to going to school, to sitting on the chair, to listening quietly to your teacher. And so when you're not used to it, then you are uncomfortable, you get anxious, you get frustrated, and you aren't able to continue. So being regular, being continuous in our formal ubudiya, in our daily prayers, in our namaz, in our salah, in our recitation of the Quran, in our recitation of certain du'as, such as du'a-i kumal or du'a tawassul, right? These are done on certain specific days. Du'a-i kumal is done on Thursday. When we do these things regularly and we do them enough, after a certain time, we will be able to pay more attention and we will be able to focus more on this formal ubudiyah. But if our prayers are few and far between, and our du'as, our supplications are few and far between, then of course that few and far between that we do this ubudiyah, it will be very difficult to pay attention to what we are doing.
IRIB English Radio. Our website, www.parshtoday.com.
Now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Ja'far Ja'far.
There's a very beautiful hadith from the 8th Imam, Imam al-Ridha alayhi salam, where he describes how every hope or every desire has to have action coupled with that. Just like when I have hope in God, it has to have action coupled with it. So if I have hope to get cured, I must go to the doctor. If my car is broken, I have to go to a mechanic. This is what God wants us to do. He wants us to use our intellect. So this hadith is very beautiful. The Imam alayhi salam says, سَبْعَةُ أَشْيَا بِغَيْرِ سَبْعَةِ أَشْيَا مِنَ الْإِسْتِهْزَىٰ. He says, if seven things are without seven other things, it is ridiculed, or it is ridiculous almost. Istihza comes from the word haza'a. Haza'a means something which is ridiculous. So if you have seven things, but they're lacking seven other things, it is a ridiculous request, or it is a ridiculous ideology that you have. And then he describes what these seven things are. And he says, for the first one, مَنِ اسْتَغْفَرَ بِلِسَانِهِ وَلَمْ يَنْدَمْ بِقَلْبِهِ فَقَدْ اسْتَهْزَأَ بِنَفْسِهِ. He who requests forgiveness from God with his tongue, but if his heart is not regretful, he has ridiculed himself. He seems ridiculous in the eyes of God, in other words. And then he continues, and this is where we get the proper example of tawakkul. وَمَنْ سَأَلَ اللَّهَ التَّوْفِيقِ وَلَمْ يَجْتَهِدْ فَقَدْ اسْتَهْزَأَ بِنَفْسِهِ. And he who asks God for success without putting any effort has ridiculed himself. I pray to God that, go God, I want to pass this exam. Yeah? And then I sit at home watching TV. I ridiculed myself. Angels are laughing at me. What kind of person is this? This is not how it works. I think many of us did this in our young days, isn't it? We prayed earnestly to God, Ya Allah, make me pass this exam. And then I went out with my friends at night. God is saying, what a ridiculous person. We have ridiculed ourselves. And then the hadith continues. It says, he who seeks precaution and he who seeks safety, but he himself does not abstain from that thing, has ridiculed himself. So if a person wants to seek safety from backbiting, but yet he goes out and hangs out with people who are backbiting, has ridiculed himself. You must stay away from that thing. And this is where we get that understanding that God will never use His own hand to do something. Obviously, God doesn't have a hand, but you know what I mean, right? You will have to do things for yourself in the course of your lives. And this is where the tawakkul comes into place. God wants you to take certain steps.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Foresight Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode and another great tip, fi amanillah, and God bless you all. جل في ولا هو أنسي وملاذي أحتمي بحما حسبنا الله ونعم الوكيل نعم المولى ونعم النصير.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, everyone. Welcome to Arab English Radio. This is Asma, your humble host for today's episode, and you're hearing me from Q&A on Islamic Belief, where you could get the answers to all your questions. Well, today we have Dr. Karimi, scholar of religious studies, who will help us with the answers. Assalamu alaikum and welcome, Dr. Karimi.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you here. Well, as the ritual for this program, we will ask you some questions and then you are going to help us with the answers.
Sure.
So, there's been this question that is asking about backbiting. We know that in our holy book of Quran, we have this fact that adultery, considering the deadly sins that are mentioned in all the religions, adultery is bigger than even murdering other people. As in considering the fact that the greatness of a sin, the deadly sins, if we consider them, then adultery is even considered to be worse than murdering other people. Now, in our holy book, we have that backbiting is even worse than adultery. So how shall these things come together? How do we justify these three things?
Sure. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. First of all, at least when it comes to the Noble Book of Quran, we cannot find any verse referring to this claim that adultery is greater than murder or murder is greater than the adultery. What you mentioned regarding backbiting being worse than adultery is not mentioned in the Quran, but we have some narrations mm-hmm. regarding this. So this is the fact that there
so
are
so we have no fact considering saying that adultery is worse than a murdering.
No. And at least there is no verse in the Quran.
But we have narrations.
No, not regarding this point too. Mm-hmm. I will come to this point, which
from where
sin
this comes
is greater.
Out?
I'm not sure. We need to ask the one who has sent the question. But I will come to that because we have some different narrations when it comes to telling us which sin is greater than the mm-hmm. other. I will discuss that. What we have in the Noble Book of Quran regarding backbiting is the famous verse of chapter Hujurat, verse 12, verse where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala calls backbiting as being like eating the flesh of your dead brother. أَيُحِبُّ أَحَدُكُمْ يَأْكُلَ لَحْمَ أَخِيهِ مَيْتًا فَكَرِهْتُمُهُ. Will any of you love to eat the flesh of his dead brother? You will hate it. But now, when it comes to the narrations, so the question is about the greatness of the sins. Which one is greater than the other in terms of...
Do we have such a concept?
Yeah. To some extent, we have this concept. And that is, first of all, we have the concept of the minor sins and the major sins.
Mm-hmm.
So from one dimension, we can, based on the narrations, we can divide the sins into two categories, the major sins and the minor sins. This is for sure. But now the point is that what is the definition of the minor sin and that of the
exactly,
major
yes.
sin? And there are some differences of viewpoints I mean, when it comes to the at least Shia scholars. But there is no doubt about the fact that we have minor sins and major sins, and this can be understood from the Noble Book of Quran. So there is no doubt about that. Although some mystics say that you cannot call any sin as minor, because at the end of the day you are disobeying God, so it's a major sin. Anyway.
Because a simple lie may turn into a great murder.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah,
so there is no...
No, what is mentioned by the mystics is that even a very, I mean, a small sin, it is an act of obedience against your creator. So you cannot call it a minor sin. At the end of the day, you are disobeying God.
Exactly.
So from that perspective, there is no concept as minor sin. So this is a mystical definition and understanding of the word. But when it comes to the verses of the Quran, this is a true conclusion from the verses, that there are minor sins and major sins. For example, chapter Nisa, verse 31 reads, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم إن تجتنبوا كبائر ما تنهون عنه. If you avoid the major sins that you are forbidden, نكفر عنكم سيئاتكم, then we will forgive your sayyat, which according to many scholars refer to minor sins. So here we have kaba'ir, major ones, and sayyat, the minor sins. Also in chapter Shura, verse 37, we have the concept of kaba'ir al-ithmi wal-fawahish, the major sins and indecencies. When it comes to the narrations, there are many narrations referring to this fact that we have major sins and minor sins. In Al-Kafi by Sheikh Kunini, there is a chapter called Bab al-Kaba'ir, a chapter, a section on major sins, and there are 24 narrations in this regard. But what is the criterion, or what are the criteria for calling a sin a major sin and the other sins the minor ones? There are a couple of criteria mentioned by these scholars. For example, one criterion is that if... for a sin, there is a punishment mentioned in the Quran, specifically in the Quran or in the narrations, that is a major sin. For example, we have it for lying or for backbiting. There is a specific punishment mentioned for it. This is one criterion.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
The other one is that we know for sure, for example, that backbiting is a major sin because of the verses and narrations. And then the other narration is telling us that another sin is greater than that sin, which is for sure the major sin. So that sin should also be called the major sin. The other point is repetition of minor sins. A sin might be minor, but if you repeat that, then it
turns into a major sin.
According to another criterion, some scholars believe that ta'zir, which is a specific kind of punishment for the sins, is a kind of indication for that sin being a major one. Now, what are the number of the major sins? There are different numbers mentioned in the narrations, like we have some narrations referring to 7 sins, 19, 10, 20, 31, 34, and 40. So my first point is that, first of all, there is no doubt about the fact that we have minor sins and major sins. Second of all, there is a kind of disagreement among the scholars about the true definition of the major sins and minor sins.
So it differs from one scholar to another.
Yeah, for sure, some of the sins are great and major. I mean, there is no doubt about, I mean, for example, lying, backbiting, murdering. All the scholars agree about, for example, these three being major sins.
These are very general and clear to everyone.
Exactly. Now, having said that, I would like to come back to the question, because the question talks about, for example, which sin is greater? Is it adultery? Is it backbiting? Is it murdering? The other point that I would like to mention is that when it comes to the negative effects of the sins, we can divide the sins into different categories. For example, there are some sins, the negative effect of which is that they take away your blessings. For example, abandoning enjoining good and forbidding the evil, or if you are ungrateful toward the blessings of God. There are some sins which would, according to the narrations, make you regretful, like killing other people, like abandoning prayer and zakat. There are some sins which cause, falling divine afflictions and calamities upon the people, like, not helping the oppressed people. There are some sins the effect of which is that it will shorten your span of life,
mm-hmm.
one of them being abandoning relation with your kings and folk and adultery.
So we have personal sins and social sins as well.
Exactly. Now, having said that, whether, adultery is greater or murder is greater, each one of them can be, greater than the other from one perspective. For one, maybe the worldly punishment is greater than the other. I'm talking about the negative consequences. For the other one, the punishment in the grave might be greater, or the punishment in the hereafter. So maybe you cannot say for sure that
which one of them is greater than the other.
And the next point is that not all the cases are the same. There are some details for each scene that not every murder is like the other.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? There are different
exactly.
occasions,
even
different
the audience
situations.
Can get that,
putting aside the religion, when it comes to human laws, people agree that one murder is more severe and more abominable than the other.
Exactly.
But what about the that narration which talk about backbiting is greater than and worse than adultery? Again, the point regarding this narration is that this narration is talking about one aspect of backbiting being worse than adultery. So it doesn't necessarily mean that, for example, the punishment in the hereafter for backbiting is greater than adultery. It might be that, but it's not necessary. Let me explain it by referring to the narration. The Holy Prophet, addressing his companion Abu Dhar, told him that be away from backbiting because it is greater than adultery. It seems that Abu Dhar, like many of other people, was also surprised, because we are talking about adultery, which is a great sin, and just backbiting, telling some words
against
another person.
Yeah, it seems very strange.
So why this is greater than adultery? So he said, Ya Rasulallah, wa lima dhalik, babi anta wa ummi. He asked about the reason, and the Holy Prophet said, لَأَنَّ الرَّجُلْ يَزْنِي وَيَتُوبُ إِلَى اللَّهِ فَيَتُوبُ اللَّهُ إِلَيْهِ. Because of the fact that when a man commits adultery, then it is possible for him just to repent to God and he will be forgiven.
Mm-hmm.
This is only حَقُّ اللَّهِ, the right of God. There is no حَقُّ النَّاسِ,
uh-huh,
the right of the people.
So that is the point.
And وَالْغِيبَ لَا تُغْفَرْ حَتَّى يَغْفِرْهَا صَاحِبْهَا. But mm-hmm. when you backbite, then you are not forgiven unless the one who is backbitten may forgive you. So this is my point, that when we compare different sins, one can be greater and worse than the other from one perspective and not from all perspectives. Here, when we are talking about a kind of comparison between backbiting and adultery, the fact that ghiba or backbiting is a sin related to haqqun nas, the rights of the people. And we know that for the rights of the people, if you want to be forgiven, then you need to, ask God to forgive that person. This is the issue of haqqun nas. But adultery is not like that. You do not need to go to other people.
It's between you and between God.
Yeah. So from this perspective, we can call backbiting as a sin greater than adultery. Does it mean that necessarily the divine punishment on the hereafter is like this? We are not sure about that. At least the narration is not talking about that. So again, I go back to my point that in some narrations, there are different cases when we see that there are comparison between different scenes or even different acts of worship. Like this act of worship is better than the other. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't mean that necessarily from all aspects and dimensions, maybe one is worse than the other in terms of worldly issues.
Or consequences that it causes.
And consequences. In terms of what we're talking about, is talking about the fact that if you want to repent to God, when it comes to backbiting, you need to, do both. Asking God to forgive you. And maybe go
and your Philemon, the brother you have backbited.
Of course, according to the scholars, it's not necessary for you to go to that person because in many cases it may
it bring causes
about
more another, problems.
Yeah, more problems. You ask God to forgive that person. You do mm-hmm. some acts of worship and ask God to give the reward to that person.
Anyway. So the answer to this question that which sin is greater or deadlier than the other, there is no special answer, right? We can only say that we have major sins.
We have major sins and minor sins, and some major sins are for sure. This is a kind of agreement among the scholars that these, like at least seven sins, are greater than the other sins. But among these seven sins, which one is greater, we cannot say for sure. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to the minor sins, again, we cannot say for sure. At the end of the day, all these are acts of disobedience, and we need to be away from all of them.
Yeah, exactly. So thank you. This is all the time that we've got for today's episode. So you are listening to Arabic English Radio. I hope today's episode was fruitful enough to help you with a better understanding of Islamic concept. For more information, you can visit parstoday.com. Until next session and a new episode of Q&A on Islamic Belief, may Allah protect and bless you all.
إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن علي وحسين وحسن.
In the limelight.
Renowned environmentalist and author Naomi Klein has argued that the United States has experienced the early stages of a rolling judicial coup as the Supreme Court took a sledgehammer to abortion rights, gun control laws, and the federal government's authority to tackle greenhouse gas emissions that are fueling the global climate emergency. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Jake Johnson, journalist. This article is published under the heading, "The U.S. is in the midst of a shock and awe judicial coup," Naomi Klein says. Stay tuned for more. Renowned environmentalist and author Naomi Klein argued recently that the United States experienced the early stages of a rolling judicial coup as the Supreme Court took a sledgehammer to abortion rights, gun control laws, and the federal government's authority to tackle greenhouse gas emissions that are fueling the global climate emergency. Klein wrote in a column for Intercept, pointing also to the right-wing high court's decisions to weaken indigenous sovereignty and further undermine the separation of church and state, "We have witnessed a shock and awe judicial coup. And now this, a decision that eviscerates the Environmental Protection Agency's power to regulate a major source of the carbon emissions, destabilizing our planet," wrote Klein, who for years has explored the ways in which reactionary political forces and corporations have taken advantage of crises to impose their will, a method she has dubbed the shock doctrine. West Virginia VEPA marks a seismic win for such forces, which have spent decades coordinating and taking legal action against the federal government's regulatory authority, particularly when it comes to challenging the ability of corporations to pollute and degrade the environment as they please. The ruling judicial coup coming from this court is by no means over, Klein warned recently, adding, next term, the Supreme Court will hear a redistricting case that could well make it far easier to concoct a legal pretense for overriding the popular vote in elections in favor of state-appointed electors, the very thing that Donald Trump attempted but failed to do, because enough people were afraid of ending up in jail. There is no reason to believe that a group of people whose very presence on the bench required grotesque abuses of democracy would somehow draw the line at thwarting it, she added. The moment to stop them from getting the chance is right now. Klein argued that to combat the right-wing justices sweeping attacks on basic freedoms and the climate, President Joe Biden and the narrowly Democratic Congress must challenge the underlying legitimacy of the U.S. Supreme Court and advance an aggressive climate action agenda. History contains crossroads when a single set of decisions can alter the trajectory of a people or even a planet, Klein continued. The Biden administration's response to the Supreme Court's 6-3 EPA ruling, hot on the heels of other outrageous power grabs, is a moment like that. In the wake of the court's decision, climate groups and progressive lawmakers made clear that Biden and Congress have at their disposal numerous executive and legislative tools to rein in fossil fuel use, slash planet warming emissions, and bolster renewable energy production. Whether they opt to use them is a matter of political will. Klein wrote, Biden and the Democrats are currently carrying toward a wave of defeats. But it's not too late to get back on track. They have just been handed a winning platform. Use the Supreme Court's attack on urgent carbon control as a catalyst to build a more meaningful democracy and take transformational climate action at the same time. If they decide to run with it, everybody on this planet wins. If they refuse, they deserve every loss coming their way.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha
Now in Islam, which is our present discussion, these big powers who want to plunder our wealth are the ones who regard Islam as being in conflict with their interests. We see that the Prophet belonged to the lower strata. Allah verily hath shown grace to the believers by sending unto them a messenger of their own. It is for this reason